Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm having a really good time right up until this moment. I want to thank my friend Johnny for, he tried to be a host. Thank God he's got Linda to help him because it was a difficult assignment. He did call me this morning, though, and invite me to his room to watch a race car race or something with he and his wife, and I was in the middle of a riveting program, so I declined his invitation and went back to watching Scooby-Doo. I want to thank the committee for inviting me and anybody who had anything to do with me getting here, particularly United Airlines. I don't know how your alcoholism runs, but this is what goes on in my head. I mean, I fly every once in a while, and if you fly from Southern California to Florida, it really isn't a big deal, because if there's a medical emergency on the plane, they've got like 100 airports to land at on the way. But when you fly from Southern California to Hawaii, if there's a medical emergency, you're screwed, particularly if you're the emergency. So I worried about that the entire flight over, and the pilot was a little confused with why I hugged him so deeply on the way. And then I get here and I get laid. How great is that? Outdoors in public. It happened a lot when I was drinking, but it's never happened in sobriety. I'm like, I can hardly, so it was exciting. And I get laid again this morning. It's twice in one weekend. That's like a record. Anyway, I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the people who have talked before me. I think what's really interesting is, you know, Friday night starts out the weekend, and it's like Paul got us off to a really big start, and Judy got us off to a really big start. Everybody's all excited and it's all jazzed up, and all day Saturday, and then Jeff last night, and everybody's up, 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 up. And my job this morning is to crash us down to the ground. He's going to bring us right down to reality so we can go back to our lives. And so I'm excited to be here and thank everybody who's participated. Thank you for inviting me and Johnny and Linda for hosting me. And I'm hoping it says on his little sheet, take her back to the airport. And the luau was great. I mean, you know what? I don't know. I want to go home and learn how to do that. I practiced in my room last night. It was not attractive, but so anyway, here's what my sponsor tells me. My sponsor, who has no creativity, basically says the same thing to me every time I have an opportunity to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She gives me the same direction. She says, tell him your name and tell him the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And I don't know about you, but I never knew that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known that I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. But I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. Coupled with that, if I would have known I was going to report to you, I would not have done some of the things that I did, but and coupled with that, I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts. There's nothing more exciting for me than leaving work on April 2nd, going back on April 15th, and figuring out you've been there the entire time. It just it makes the time between paychecks so much shorter. I love blackouts, but if you're not paying a lot of attention and you're a blackout drinker, it makes what it used to be like a little fuzzy. So a lot of what I report to you has been reported to me by other people. And I just have to believe they were telling me the truth. Coupled with that, I have a job. I had a job where I had to get a fingerprint clearance. And I fingerprint really, really well. I roll right along with the printer. I don't go too fast. I don't resist it. I just roll right along with the printer. And I was being printed for my job, and I didn't want to raise any red flags. So I said very casually to the woman doing my printing, I said, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like the fifth step, only it's in the wrong order because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how, but I remember when my prints came back and the woman called me. I don't know if you have a lot of interactions with non-alcoholic people, but non-alcoholic people, it seems when they're going to give us bad news, they're a little hesitant in their voice. And this woman was really hesitant when she called me up and told me my report had come back. And I said, uh-huh. And she says, you know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long. I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. Do you want to see it? Well, of course I did. So I went down there and I read that report. And I can tell you this, I know a lot more about what it used to be like, having read that report, than I did before then. So I don't know if the story is true or not, but I like the story, so I just keep telling it. And here's the way it goes. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. And I'm really sorry I waited that long. But I had absolutely no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I thought my father was weird. I had no idea it was alcoholism. I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking I would never drink, and I certainly didn't think I can't wait until I do drink, but I didn't think about drinking at all. And yet I'm 13 years old. I'm on a camping trip with a group of girls. We're camped on the beach in Southern California. And I remember that Friday night as clearly as if it were tonight. I remember that Friday night getting into that tent, and in my pillowcase was a bottle of vodka. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God. But I've never been able to confirm that. I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And our book talks about a sense of ease and comfort that comes before we ever take the drink. I had a sense of ease and comfort before I ever took my first drink of alcohol. I had absolutely no idea what it would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with. It was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top. I drank half the bottle. I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had resentments out there. But one of my early resentments here is I heard you talk about your first drink. And you described the warmth in your mouth. And you talked about how it felt as it swished around in there. And it somehow trickled down your throat. And it hit your stomach and it exploded. And it went to your fingernails and your toenails and you grew a couple inches. Your pimples fell off. You dropped 20 pounds. You became Prince Charles. Wonderful things happened to you. And that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent and I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I would discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. I know it's a visual, but the second person's got to be really careful about what they're doing, but... I didn't know that at 13. I did somehow know that the body was made up of energy. And I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be centrally located, when it seemed to be in one place, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, when I got here, you explained to me that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit, like, you've never been sick. I hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there, and that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most amazing, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous, spiritual, wonderful experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I just recently found out that they make vanilla extract without alcohol in it anymore, which I think is a total ripoff for our children. But I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a weakness for it. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. Anyway, but you know what? I don't know. This is unusual. Alcoholics, we sort of know stuff that other people don't know. I mean, we sort of intuitively know. My next-door neighbors who are not alcoholic, they've been to my house a few times. They have never once eaten or drank a single thing out of my bathroom. And we just intuitively know. And how do we know? I mean, I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, an office drinker, a backyard drinker, a dumpster drinker. I didn't really specialize. I just drank. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. And you probably don't have any in Kona. I mean, it's like high class here, but I like those ones that have sawdust on the floor. The mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The pulse here on the bars ripped, or people trying to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. It's always nice if there's a piece of broken furniture in a corner someplace. They used to be full of smoke. I don't know about Hawaii, but in California, you cannot smoke in a bar anymore, which makes no sense to me. I drank in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently, they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. But they would be full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. Sometimes if I'm in a cranky mood, I'll go buy one of those joints early in the morning, open the door, take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. I love that smell, but I'm fascinated by the quality of people who drank in there. There were like CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents. There were admirals in the Air Force, neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were, and I... But we weren't sitting around having conversations like, "Well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva?" We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State, graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. It almost killed me when I got to you because I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. In retrospect, I can tell you I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm a daily drinker. I'm a blackout drinker. And I graduated college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed at San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. And one of those people, I'm doing something well. I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And I'm going to tell you about my roommate. I'm a bar drinker, chronic alcoholic, but even in the height of my alcoholism, in the worst of my alcoholism, I have always had a tremendous amount of compassion. And I'm in a bar drinking, and the guys that drank in the bars that I drank in had very little creativity. They had two basic lines: my wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight. That was typically the end of their pickup lines, but some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I have all of this compassion. So I would say, okay, listen, I'll take you home with me tonight. I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close. Being a lady of my word, I would take him home with me. We would get to my house. I would send him into the bedroom over here on the left, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He would go into the bedroom on the left. I would go into my bedroom on the right, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights I was okay with her. Some nights she didn't mind at all. Other nights, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging on my bedroom door, which I had, of course, get some rest. I had 7 o'clock classes. I got to get some rest. And if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent. You'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. And I don't think I'm leaving because she's a little annoyed with me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. My intent is to knock him in the private parts, but men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes. I was a lot younger then, but it was a good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at his car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends, and pretty soon it'd be two or three of them, one of me. Well, it's not fair anymore. I say uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and go for him. Good fight for a few minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend, and pretty soon, be 4 or 5 of them, one of me. It's not fair. I say uncle, and they take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. Never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time, it's a fair fight. This time, I'm going to take him. And when you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. And I have another one pending. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I drank during a time when the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're pretty testy about it now, but I never really had any consequence. Well, they took my license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. I never really had any consequences. I'd pay an attorney $1,000, which was a lot of money, and he'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, and that would kind of be the end of it. I'd never hear any more about it. But one time I had two pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, you should worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. And started talking to this guy sitting next to me, and luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary, and I came up with a plan. I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. Now, the problem for me is typically my solution is worse than the original problem, but which is why at 37 years sober, I'm still actively sponsored. Because still today, my solutions can be worse than the original problem. But I didn't have a sponsor then, so we went over the mortuary and we got a death certificate and we put my name on it. And we filled out all the pertinent information and we forged a doctor's signature and we sent it to the court because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney and told him he didn't need to worry, and he didn't worry, I didn't worry, nobody worried for, I don't know what it was, 30, 60, 100 days, I don't know what it was, when the light came on behind me again. And this time the judge wanted to see me, and I couldn't figure out why he wanted to see me. He never wanted to see me before, but you know what, I'm game, I'll go. And I'll never forget him looking at me, he said, "Miss Ochoa, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity I said, "I don't know, bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. It never occurred to me. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I went, I got a job in the profession of my choice in Chico, California, which is about as far north from San Diego as you can get. I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took two bottles of booze, I took some beer, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which isn't the place you want to shoot for, but I got to Santa Ana, I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway, I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place, it was full of smoke, it had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned. And I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. But at some point it had turned. It began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every year of my life. Where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and I didn't tell you about the times that I would come out of a blackout standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. In 1975, the state of California was starting to get really serious about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average, And I got pulled over one more time, and I was doing the field sobriety test. I'm good at field sobriety tests. I practice field sobriety tests. I'm one of those people, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time because the cops were always looking for me. They knew what I drove. They knew what I drove if I had my car, your car, a company car, a stolen car. They always knew what I drove, and they were always looking for me. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And when I prayed God was my last drunk driving assault charge, I was doing an A. If I mentioned the officer, I thought I was doing A-plus work. By then I knew touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. I know how to walk heel to toe. This morning I could stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I am really good at field sobriety tests, and at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, "Well, I can't even do that sober." Well, then I had just confessed, and so on what I pray God was my last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, "Okay," and I turned around, and I said, See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. I was turned around. He cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were real criminals, and there were like prostitutes in there. There were burglars, women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California, they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. I explained the plan very carefully and very slowly to the criminals. And it was an easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around her neck. We're getting her keys, and we're getting out of here. I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me, and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" I said, "Fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out." I was going like a madwoman on those bars. Couple problems with styrofoam cups. First one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And I got released in the morning on an OR. I hadn't been released on an OR in a long time. And I knew they were making a mistake, but I didn't think I should be the one to tell them about it. And I went to court on that charge. I had the public defender standing next to me the day the $1,000 attorney was gone. The only thing I've ever wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. A family and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. And I'd given up my profession of choice for one more drink. I was unemployed and unemployable. I was 26 years old, and I was drunk. And I had the public defender standing next to me. And because the state of California was starting to hand out some serious consequences for drunk driving, I was being sentenced to 15 years in prison. In the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you I took the alternative. I came here, I saw the 12 steps, I worked them all in the first week and a half, and I skyrocketed to recovery. And, well, quite frankly, if Johnny wasn't here, I would tell you that story. But that's not my story. I stood in court and thought about it. Jail alternative. Jail alternative. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. And I didn't like this kid. I mean, he did nothing. He wept and he cried. That's all. He think he'd get a little part-time job. He was 8 months old, contribute something. But he did nothing, and I didn't like him. But I was willing to use him that morning. I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail. I was a single parent and a self-supporting through my own contributions. And he told me he'd put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I would have admitted to being being a lot of things, but I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And my son was to spend the first 11 months of his life sitting in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them, sitting on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. But I believe because I had him with me made me a fit mother. And my son was going to a foster home, and I was offered this alternative. And Bill writes something in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, he writes something like this: to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And I don't think by alcoholic death, I don't think Bill means lay down and have him put dirt on your face. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is to continue to live in the despair, to continue to live in the incomprehensible demoralization, to continue to live sitting on bar stools, dreaming dreams and planning plans and not being able to get off the bar stool and get it done, to continue to live promising the people we love that we'll never do it again and meeting that promise with every fiber in our body, and then we do it again. And we see that look in their eye, that look that says, "What's wrong with me? Don't you love me enough? What's wrong with me?" I think that's the alcoholic death that Bill talks about, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on the spiritual basis. And I think that was the choice I was being asked to make that morning, but I had absolutely no idea. Jail alternative. And I had that day what I know this morning was a moment of clarity. Because as clear as I knew anything, I knew if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. It's for life. And I don't know why I knew it, but I knew it. And I took the alternative and I left the courtroom and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing, what the alternative he gave me, on that day I walked into grace. I can tell you this morning that God has always had me in the palm of his hand. I can tell you this morning that God has always protected me. But I can also tell you that I could not access that grace. And that morning, for whatever reason, I was able to access the grace. And I can tell you that I know I accessed God's grace that morning because I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And I never planned to not take a drink of alcohol. I never tried to not take a drink of alcohol. I never tried to control and enjoy my drinking. It never occurred to me ever to do anything about my drinking. And yet on October 4th, 1975, I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And that day I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a speaker meeting, and I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around and didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I could not figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. In fact, I figured I'm going to go back and tell him he made a heinous error. He sent me to the wrong place, the Sears School of Safe Driving. I'll understand that. I don't understand sending me to a place where people don't drink. And the other thing I heard in that meeting was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home and read the book. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the right. I don't know I'm a thief. My sponsor told me I'm a thief. I think it's critical you have a sponsor. I think it's imperative that I have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in my life as I am. I mean, it irritates me sometimes, but her perspective of my life is completely different. I mean, here's the thing. I'm in a bar drinking. I find some keys. I go find the car that they fit. I'm driving home. My sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. Rationalization, justification, and denial. So I can't find the answers in that book. I've decided I've stolen the wrong book. I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I figure I better get the answer book before I go talk to the judge. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. It's the only reason I came back. I don't think it matters what your motive is, what your desires are, what your intentions are. I think what's critical is what your actions are. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book, and I've been coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. That meeting was a small discussion meeting, and that meeting I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any lengths to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you, unless you're sleeping with him. What is it? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. And then I saw him, and I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I don't know about in Hawaii, but I work with adolescents who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They could put a homeless family in there with him. But his weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin nod out, and I can probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked. The next day I snuck down to his office. I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So it's a little hope for the newcomer, but but it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. I'm going to do something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. Every time I have thought my life was falling apart, if I don't drink and don't die, I move far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I thought it was falling apart, what was really happening, it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. And I can tell you this morning, I'm going through one of those times right now in my life. I had something happen to me in February that felt like my whole life was falling apart. I've been at my job for 22 years, and for reasons that are too complicated to explain, I had to resign my job of 22 years. And I believe my life is falling apart. I believe that this is the absolutely worst thing that, and I plummeted into a depression. The grief process is hideous, unless you're in the anger part of it. I like that part of it, but not big on the depression part of it. But and I'm in the middle of that right now, and my sponsor, who is not as emotionally involved in my life as I am, says to me, either believe what you've been saying or you don't. Either believe what you've been saying or not, because every time I thought my life was falling apart, it was really falling together, and it's had to be exactly that way for God to move me. See, I get content. Right here, right now, I have a fabulous life. Right here, right now, things are good. And when I'm content, what I tend to do is dig a little rut. I decorate it, and I'm very okay right here, right now, but God has a plan for me bigger than anything I could imagine for myself. Bigger than anything I could want for myself, there's a plan for me. And sometimes for me to get into that plan, God's going to come kick me in the butt to get me out of that rut. And I feel this morning, right here, right now, I feel as though I've been kicked in the butt. And I have to believe my own experience and the experience of the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous, that even though I think it's falling apart, what's really happening is it's falling together. And when I get, if I don't drink and I get far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, I will be able to report that it had to be exactly this way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. I just hope he doesn't want me living in a refrigerator box under a bridge somewhere. But I believe that old man. And I hadn't believed a human being in a long time, but I believed him. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you that I did do the things he told me to do. I went to meetings. I went to two a week. I thought it was really, really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. I had the book, so I read it. Every night I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. I am so grateful that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous shared the way the book says tells us to share. I am so grateful that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous talked about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because what happened to me in sitting in those meetings, when you shared what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine. And when you shared what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine. And my alcoholism woke up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been in a lot of pain in the last 37 years. Painful things happen, not just for alcoholics, but for other people. Painful things happen in life. I've been in pain in 37 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. Not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I've ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, your alcoholism woke mine up. And in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I became an alcoholic. And I felt, and that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was powerless over alcohol. And the book says this is the first step in recovery. I wish I could tell you then that I looked at the rest of the steps. I worked them all in a minute and a half and skyrocketed to recovery. But that's not the truth for me. I think the most powerful prayer we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a 7-step prayer. I think the 7-step prayer is the most powerful prayer that we have. Selfish and self-centered, that's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 7-step prayer says something like this. It says, God, take all of me, good and bad. How powerful is that for an alcoholic of my nature? Take it all, good and bad. I don't have to judge it anymore. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, a right thing, a wrong thing, or my favorite, God's will or my will? In Southern California, we have the God's will or my will debate all the time. And This is how I think God's will works, just for me. God's will works like this. God's will is the GPS in my car. I set her to where I want to go, and then I start driving. Pretty soon she'll say to me, in 175 feet, turn right. Well, I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. So sometimes at 175 feet, I don't want to turn right. I want to turn left. So I turn left. And my GPS doesn't say, Patio, you're a lousy driver. My GPS just reconfigures itself. And then pretty soon she'll say, in 200 feet, turn left. Well, 200 feet, I don't want to turn left. I want to go straight. And my GPS doesn't say, Patio, you are a lousy driver. Pull over. Let somebody else drive this car. She just reconfigures her route, kind of like an Al-Anon, just reconfigures her route. And she just keeps reconfiguring her route until I eventually get to where it is I was headed for in the first place. Never does she tell me I'm a horrible driver. I think God's will works that way too. God puts opportunities in front of me, and I look at them and think, no, I don't want that, and I go around it. God doesn't say, Patty, you're a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. God just puts another opportunity in front of me. Then I get to that, and I go, not so much, and I go around that one. God doesn't say, Patty, oh, you were such a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Give up all your sponsees and get out of here. God just puts up another opportunity until I finally make a healthy choice. I think that's how God's will works in my life. So it's take it all, good and bad. I don't have to judge it. Good thing, bad thing, right thing, wrong thing. Leave me with this. Leave me with what I need to be of service to you and my fellows. How powerful is that? Selfish and self-centered. That's what walked in here. I have done very little. I admitted to my innermost self I was alcoholic. I came to believe the people in Alcoholics Anonymous were telling me the truth. I made a decision to do what you said you had done. I wrote about my favorite topic, me. I bored somebody for about an hour and a half having to listen to it. And as a result of those very simple things, I'm now in a position where all I care about is being of service to God and my fellows. How powerful is that? And I think too many people miss it. Too many people muck it up too much. Too many people miss the simplicity of Alcoholics Anonymous. Steps 8 and 9 for me were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. And it wasn't just saying sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Then I'd do it again and get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. So it wasn't just saying sorry. It was about living my life differently. But I don't know how to do that. This is the only way I know how to live. I don't know how to live any different than this. But you do. And I come here. And you share how to go to work and not take a drink. How to be a daughter and not take a drink. How to be a parent and not take a drink. How to be a friend, and you share your experience today, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. You talk about that and not taking a drink of alcohol. And you allow me to take your experience out into the world and live it, and it becomes my experience. I am the woman I am this morning because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have shared with me how you live your life. And when I take your experiences out and live them, I have amended every relationship in my life with the experiences of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. 10, 11, and 12 keep me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? It seems to me when I'm focused on my problem, God can't do a thing with it. But when I'm focused on your problem, God can come in and take care of mine. Have a commitment. Be a part of. If you want this to be yours, have a part. Take a part in it. I think the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous is coffee maker. And I know that for this reason. My Monday night meeting, they made me coffee maker. And after the meeting, they gave me this big pot to take home and this big can of coffee. And off I went. And I came back the next week. I filled up the pot. I opened up the can of coffee. I dumped the whole thing into the basket. Put the lid on, plugged it in. It took forever to perk, and some guy came in, he poured himself a cup, he took a big old jolt off of that coffee, and his eyeballs rolled back in his head, and the next guy took some, and his eyeballs rolled back, and pretty soon people were just taking half a cup and sipping, but nobody said who made this will. Nobody complained about it. And then after the meeting, the secretary's given his announcements. He said, you know, we had a steering committee, and we realized coffee maker is the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is so important we're giving Patty an assistant. And the next week, my assistant and I showed up, and I filled up the pot with water. He opened the can. He measured it into the pot. We put it on, and it perked. And one more time, you didn't tell me what to do. You showed me what to do. You have never told me what to do. You have always shown me how to do it. Step 11, my prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done, and I'm so naive, I believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. And my prayer at night is a little scary or offered to anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. I don't flip people off on the freeway anymore. I still count, but I don't announce the number of items in the 10-item or less line at the grocery store. And I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I do knowing I'm going to say that prayer tonight. I challenge you to use it. I guarantee you if you use it for 90 days, it'll change your life. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, an opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic. To look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to live that way anymore. I want to tell you a couple of things before Glenn comes in with the hook and pulls me off the podium. My son, who was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought him with me. I didn't know what to do with him. I have no idea how to be a parent. I brought him to meetings with me. I think they have the worst of our alcoholism. They deserve the best of our recovery, and it starts here. And I brought him with me, and you would take him and hold him, and you'd bounce him and love him, whatever you do with him. And at the end of the meeting, you'd give him back to me. And I'd bring him to another meeting, another meeting, another meeting. And everything my son knows, he learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught him how to be kind and loving and gentle. You taught him how to be caring. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that. But you have to take the good with the bad, so... And I share that with you for this reason. If just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous were enough, my son would have never had a problem. My son's been to more meetings than most of the women I sponsor. He's seen women detox on my couch. He's seen people have seizures in meeting. If just sitting here, if intellect, if knowledge were enough, my son would have never had a problem. But my son had a journey that alcoholic men have to go on. He went to places that no human being should go, and he did things that no human being should do. And I got in the ring with his disease. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I got in the ring with my son's disease and I was getting beat up really badly. He had moved to San Francisco. I'm in Southern California. He called me one day, collect at work, which is a nice touch. And he said he'd been in an accident and he needed 140 stitches. It was going to cost $120. I said, oh, my God, give me the address of the hospital. I'll send a check. He said, oh, no, they need cash. I said, well, I'm in Southern California, you're in Northern California, I don't know what to do. And he taught me how to wire money, and I wired him the money. And about a week later, he called me collect at work, and he'd walked through a plate glass window, and he needed stitches, and it was going to cost $120, and I wired the money. And a couple of weeks later, he called me collect at work. I said, Patrick, you need to go to AA, and I hung up on him, and he called me collect again, and I swore at him and hung up on him, and he called me collect again, and I sent him the money. And pretty soon I had 7 or 8 MoneyGram stores going because I don't want the 17-year-old clerk to know I'm sending the money one more time. And I'm doing everything wrong. I went to Al-Anon. The good people of Al-Anon said to me, they said, Patty, you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go back there. You're embarrassing us. And I did everything wrong. I did everything wrong. The thing that I did right is I came here and I told you. I told you that I cussed at him and he hung up the phone on him. I told you that I sent him the money. I came here and I told you, and I told you. And the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous would say things to me like, Patty, aren't you embarrassed? You're 21, 22, 23 years sober. Aren't you embarrassed to be sharing this? I want you to know this. If I am ever too embarrassed to tell you the truth, I'm going to be drunk. And I don't want to drink anymore. So I came here and I told you the truth. And on October 23rd, 2002, my son had moved back to Southern California, and he called me one more time, and he said, Mom, I need help. And God did for me what I cannot do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. God won't send me money in the mail because I have the ability to go to work. But God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. And when my son told me he needed help that day, God said these words through my mouth. I said, Patrick, I can't help you anymore. Stay where you are, and I'll send somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hung up the phone and I dialed a number. I wanted to call a high-profile member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but his answering machine came on, so I called a goof. I called the biggest goof in alcohol. I would not have called this guy. Left to my own devices, I would not have called this guy. I would not have put my son's life in this man's hand, but my fingers dialed his number. And thank God he understood the traditions, because he didn't say, tell the boy to call me. He said, where is he? And I gave him the address of that motel, and he went and picked up a newcomer, and they went and got my son, and they brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for a little over 10 years, my son has been a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because he's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had the opportunity to chair the Orange County Young People in AA. And if you ever have an opportunity to be involved in a YPA event, I encourage you to take the opportunity. Young people in AA are like an infusion of enthusiasm. It's like hooking up an IV of enthusiasm. If you have an opportunity to be involved in any kind of a YPA event, please take advantage of it. But my son chaired the Young People's Convention. It was in Orange County, in Orange that year, and they had asked me to be the Saturday night speaker. And because he chaired the convention, he led the Saturday night meeting. When he introduced the speaker, he said, "I want to introduce tonight's speaker, my mother and my hero." And I started to cry, and I thought, how do you get there from where I was in that courtroom that morning, making a decision to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis? The book says this is not an easy choice. How do you get there from where I was that morning to that podium that evening, except for the 12 steps and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I got up, and tears were running down my face, and I thought, seconds and inches, as Sandy Beach used to say, seconds and inches, or as Norm Alpha used to say, I could have missed it all. Seconds and inches, if I'd have made a different choice that morning, my son would have gone to a foster home, and he'd been raised somewhere else, and he'd been introducing somebody else that night at that meeting. Seconds and inches, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. If you're new, it's not an easy choice. On November 29, 2006, I was in a hospital room at South Coast Medical Center. I don't know why I'm so weepy this morning, when my grandson was born. And I was photographing the birth of my grandson because you taught me to have a job. You said, if you want it to be yours, have a job. Don't just sit around. Don't just come in and take a chair at a meeting. If you want it to be yours, get a job. Be a coffee maker, be a greeter, be a setter-upper. Do something. Get a job. I've always had jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that morning, I was photographing the birth of my grandson, and at one point, the doctor said, "This is a good shot," and I know a little about the female anatomy. I'm thinking, no, no, this is not. This is not a good shot. And just about then, my grandson's head was born. The doctor turned the head, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I looked behind him at his mother, and I looked into the eyes of God, and I looked behind her at my son, and I looked into the eyes of God. And my grandson was born, and he walked into my heart, and he changed my life. I have learned to love in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here, he used to say, "Let us love you until you can love yourself." You didn't say that to me, but you tolerated me, and I'm grateful for that. And you taught me, "Let us love you until you can love somebody else." I think it's so much more powerful. But I've learned to love in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, growing up, I thought if you loved me, you would hurt me, and if I loved you, I would hurt you. And I made a decision as a small child I would never love. And people hurt me, they disappointed, and they let me down. As a small child, I built a wall between me and you. And that wall worked really well. It kept you out. What I didn't know about is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. But the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, one brick at a time, you've taken that brick wall down that I have built between me and you. And you have loved me and you've allowed me to love you. And I've learned to love in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when my grandson was born, he walked into my heart, he changed my life. I have never loved as deeply as I loved that little boy. He's 6 years old. He's never done a single thing wrong. I get to have him every Tuesday. I pick him up every Tuesday from preschool, and now from kindergarten, I pick him up every Tuesday, and we spend Tuesday together, and he stays with me, and we watch Scooby-Doo in bed, and we do everything his mom and dad won't let him do. And one Monday, my son called me, and he was running late, and he asked me if I could pick him up, and you know, I was in preschool at the time, and for every minute you're late, they charge you $120, so I went that Monday to pick him up. Eden comes running across the room and jumps in my arm. He says, "Grandma, Grandma, you might be confused. It's not Tuesday." But When he was five, his mother had a bounce house birthday party for him, and I went to the bounce house birthday party, and I got there early, and he was in the bounce house, and he wanted me to come in the bounce house, and I'll do anything for him. So I'm not the bounce house kind of girl, but I got in the bounce house, and he wanted to teach me how to do a bounce house somersault, and I'm like, but okay. And I'm not a good student. I'm not very limber. I'm really, but he didn't get mad. He didn't get frustrated. He just kept over and over telling me over and over how to do it. He's trying to get my legs over. He's showing me. He didn't get frustrated. I finally did a bounce house somersault. He squealed. He was so happy that I had done a bounce house somersault. And I was just happy to get out of the bounce house. And some kids came, and he wanted me back in the bounce house because he wanted me to show them how he taught me how to do a bounce house somersault, and I did it again, and I got out, and some more people came. I had to go back in the bounce house and do it again, and some more people came, and I got out, and I thought, okay, I'll do a bounce. He said, no, Grandma, I don't want you to show them. I want you to teach them how to do a bounce house somersault, and that's how Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's like a big bounce house. It's like a big bounce house. If you're new, we just want to teach you how to do a bounce house somersault. We're not going to get irritated. We're not going to get frustrated. We're just going to keep telling you the same thing over and over and over. And then we're going to have you show some other people how to do it, but eventually we're going to ask you to teach somebody else how to do a bounce house somersault. That's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. I got my hand in my sponsor's hand, but if this hand's empty, I'm losing. If this hand's empty, I'm shortchanging myself. I got to reach back and get a newcomer with this hand. And I need to teach somebody else how to do a bounce house somersault. I think I'm out of time. And I'm also out of oxygen. I have COPD, so I don't breathe well. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life. I came to you because I didn't want to go to jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. If I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. The story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room. There's a banquet, much like the luau we had last night. Tables and tables of food, any kind of food you'd ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room, they're hungry, they're dying, they're starving. And the reason they're starving is they have long wooden spoons tied to their hands, and the spoons are just a little too long, and they can't quite get the spoon to their mouth. And they're sitting amongst plenty, and they're starving. And that's how I was before I came to you. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. They took him to a room marked heaven, and in that room was the same scene, tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. But the people in that room are full, and they're happy, and they're content. And the difference is, but they had those big spoons tied to their hands, too. And they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth, but the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And she was taking a spoonful of food and feeding somebody else, and he was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And every once in a while, I get to give a spoonful of this thing to another alcoholic. And you don't have to have 37 years. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman sitting next to you. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. I don't have it. Cowards drink and use. I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to stay here. And I don't have it, but you do. And so when we pray this morning, the person on my right will give me a little courage, and the person on my left will give me a little strength. And we can do what I can't. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. And he didn't lie to me. And the thing I end with, I always end with it. I end with it because it's been my experience. And I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that we already heard read this morning. It's a line that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging a dollar to a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.